The material that we'll look at in this session is a continuation, really, of last night. The announcement this morning, I should have gotten to her before she announced it. We'll be looking actually at material finishing up chapter 14, starting with verse 52, and actually verse 53 of chapter 14. And we'll look at Jesus' trial before the high priest. And then we'll look at Jesus' trial before Pilate in chapter 15 and go to the end of that chapter then. So that's the material that we'll finish with this session. I'm feeling sad that some people are leaving already. It's like we're just getting started and we're going to experience loss and separation now. So I'd like to thank those who have been here. They're not here yet, I guess, so we'll thank them at the end. Yeah, those dedicated people without whose help and participation, none of this would have happened. Right, trying to change the top bunk is what they're working on. But I thought to center ourselves and get into this material. I put LBWs out. Could we turn to the 22nd Psalm? This is the psalm that Jesus echoes on the cross in Mark's story of his death. And I thought, could we read responsively, half verse by half verse, verses 1 to 11 in chapter 22, I mean in Psalm 22. And why don't we divide on the diagonal this way, and you people read the beginning part of the verse, and you people read the concluding part of the verse. Yeah, and you people in the middle decide where you want to go. My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?
And art thou so far from my cry, and from the words of my distress?
O my God, I cry in the daytime, but you do not answer. Yet you are the Holy One,
enthroned upon the praises of Israel.
Our forefathers put their trust in you.
They trusted and you delivered them.
They cried out to you and were delivered.
They trusted you and were not put to shame.
But as for me, I am a worm and no man,
scorned by all and despised by the people.
All who see me laugh me to scorn.
They curl their lips and wag their heads, saying,
He trusted in the Lord, let him deliver him.
Let him rescue him if he delights in him.
Yet you are he who took me out of the womb
and kept me safe on my mother's breast.
I have been entrusted to you ever since I was born.
You were my God when I was still in my mother's womb.
Be not far from me, for trouble is near,
and there is none to help.
All right, well, let's pick up the work that we were doing last night. And we had finished events in Mark's story up to Jesus' arrest. And I thought if we could pick up now with verse 53 and look at Jesus' first trial. There are two trials of Jesus, one before the Jewish high court, but because the Romans ruled the land, Jesus also had to be tried if he was to be condemned to die before the Romans. And so we have two trials of Jesus. Let's look to see how Mark tells this first story of the first trial of Jesus in the last part of chapter 14. Actually, in the last part of chapter 14, there are two trials going on in verses 53 to the end of the chapter. Mark interweaves two trial stories with one another. And again, they're like pieces of quilting that patches, if you will, that are put side by side, and they comment on one another. The first trial is the trial of Jesus, told in verse 53 and verses 55 to 65. Standing beside that is the trial of Peter. which we read first in verse 54 and then in verses 66 to the end of the chapter. Let's look at those two stories. Jesus is led inside, which is where his trial takes place, to the high priest, and there are assembled the chief priests, the elders, and the scribes, the high court of the high religious court of the Israelites. And they stand before him, and they bear false witness against him. We read in verse 56, the witnesses bearing false witness, those do not agree. This is not a trial that could stand up in a court. It's a sham of a trial. False witnesses say, we heard him say that I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another not made with hands. Jesus never says that in the Gospel of Mark. False witnesses bearing false testimony against Jesus. Finally, the high priest, seeing this sham, I suppose, decides something must be done, so he decides to question Jesus himself. Jesus' response is silence in verse 61. Again, the high priest asked him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" And Jesus said, "I am." Here again, for the third time now, we have the word Christ in the Gospel of Mark. We saw it in 1:1, we saw it in 8:29, and now in 14:61. Again, not on the lips of Jesus, but on the lips of someone else, this time the enemy of Jesus, the high priest, the one having great political power over Jesus at this point. And we noted the other day that Jesus does not say, "I am the Christ," but it's ego eimi, "I am." Echoing, of course, the Old Testament words where God says to Moses, "I am who I am, who I am." And I think it's significant that Jesus does not use a title to describe his own work in the Gospel of Mark. Titles in Mark seem to be the things that we humans grasp for, that we need to name this one Jesus, who he is, what he's about. The title Christ is one of the most significant, but we've seen others, the Son of God, the Most Holy One. We've seen other titles for Jesus too, Son of Man, which is one description that he uses for himself sometimes. But I think it's important that Jesus doesn't say, "I am the Christ," just "I am." In a way, Jesus is the Messiah, Jesus is the Christ, but with this confession of Jesus, it's that he is more than that even. I am the Messiah, but more than that, I am who I am. I am God. And that is something that shatters our titles, goes beyond our human titles. And finally, can we even say who this one God is? Titles even aren't sufficient to describe who Jesus is. Jesus finally is beyond that and is God. And in the Gospel of Mark, when we look ahead, when the curtain of the temple tears in two from top to bottom, the Holy of the Holies is no longer isolated by this curtain. God is no longer contained by this curtain. God is at loose in the world, and that's good news on the one hand, but it's also very scary and frightening that this power of God is in the world now. It's not contained. And so that's a scary, spooky thing almost, as well as good news for us. And so I think that it's significant that Jesus resists titling himself. His response implies that, yes, I am the Christ. He claims that. But even more than that, I am God, the ultimate kind of confession on the lips of Jesus. The high priest responds to this, of course, why do we need witnesses? And they don't need witnesses. They don't need a trial, even if it's a sham of a trial, because Jesus, it's not the trial that condemns Jesus. It's Jesus himself who condemns himself with this confession, I am. And so they begin to torture him in this religious trial, to spit on him, to cover his face, to strike him, and say to him, prophesy, and the guards receive him with blows. This is the trial of Jesus before the high priest that's going on inside. Jesus is willingly confessing himself as Christ, but as more than Christ even, I am who I am, identifying himself as God inside, knowing that that will lead to his death. Outside, Mark is telling about another trial. And this trial of Peter is a parody, if you will, if we can use that word, a parody of Jesus' trial inside. Peter is outside, we read in verse 54. He has come to warm himself at the fire. His trial story picks up again in verse 66. And inside, Jesus is being tried by the high priest. Outside, Peter, who tries him? The maid of the high priest. It's again, the story is topsy-turvy, upside down, and a woman, a maid of the high priest, a very lowly person, is outside trying Peter. And she asks him, and she says to him in verse 67, you also were with the Nazarene Jesus. But Peter denied it. Then again, she says in verse 69 to the bystander, this man is one of them. Again, Peter denies it. Then a second person, the bystander, says to Peter, certainly you are one of them, for you are a Galilean. And he even invokes a curse on himself. I do not know this man of whom you speak. Inside, before the high priest, Jesus is willingly confessing himself as Christ, as God, knowing that that will lead to death for himself. Outside, Peter, this one who has vowed, if I must die with you, I will not deny you. Outside, to the maid of the high priest, a parody of Jesus' trial inside, Peter is doing everything that he can to avoid confessing that he has anything to do with this Jesus the Christ. He does not want to die for him. There's more irony here too in Mark. Inside, Jesus is being struck and they're saying prophesy to him. When Jesus least looks like a prophet, like a Messiah, inside. Outside, ironically, his prophecy is coming true. In chapter 14, verse 39, Jesus says to Peter, truly I say to you, before the cock crows, twice you will deny me three times. And while Jesus is being mocked as a prophet inside, ironically outside, his prophecy is at that very moment being fulfilled.
Yeah. Do you think Mark is doing anything with the fact that cock crows, probably the trumpet from the Antonian, not really a rooster crowing, but and that whole image of when the Messiah is revealed up on the pinnacle of the temple,
the trumpet will sound. I don't know. I hadn't thought about that. That could be. That'd be another nice touch, it seems to me.
What makes you say it probably isn't a rooster?
Well, for one thing, roosters and chickens weren't allowed in Jerusalem. They would befoul the holy city, you know. And so, and the cock crow was the kind of everyday term that people used for the evening trumpet that the soldiers would blow to say, this is the curfew.
Yeah.
The curfew bell. Time to shut everything down.
And it's the enemy soldiers who would be blowing that,
right,
isn't it? And that fits nicely because in this chapter, in 14 and 15, it's not the followers of Jesus who are confessing him as Christ, it's the enemies.
Yeah.
And they're not meaning it as confession, but we hear it as that. And so for the enemy trumpet to be blowing, that's very nice. That could work really well in Mark's story, it seems to me.
Would they blow a trumpet in the early morning, do you think?
This is probably they blew it at the end of each watch.
So it could be blown in.
Can I go back with you too to that, to verse 63? Am I reading something into this? The high priest tore his garments. Is that suggesting, or can that be the suggestion, he's really exposing himself? The high priest knows that the witnesses have not truly convicted Jesus, but he's exposing himself. He just wants to get to his agenda of killing.
I think you could understand it that way. I think that word tear is important too. This is again the word schizo, which the heavens did in 110, which the temple curtain does in 1538. Here the high priest tears his garments, and in a way it's a sign of his power and authority. Now he says, why do we need witnesses? He condemns him to death. But at that, ironically, at that same time, his own power is going to be undone as the high priest. And Jesus is going to be the head of the temple, and this high priest is going to have no temple to be head of. So the tearing works ambiguously there, too.
What meant by the tearing of the garments? Is that a symbolic action that has historical meaning?
Yeah, you did that before you put the ashes on your head.
So a mourning thing.
A mourning.
And I think that what I've read is that when you condemned a person to death, that's what the person condemning them did. It's a sign of you know, mourning in a way, symbolically, that you had to condemn this person to death. But of course, the high priest is not mourning at all. Tearing, it shows what an empty act that is on his part to be rending his garment at that moment too. He's so glad to.
In the face of blasphemy, a high priest would tear his garments to show that he was not part of that.
Not part of that, yeah, separate from it, yeah. Mm-hmm. Other comments or? Okay, well, let's go on to look at the second trial of Jesus then, the trial before Pilate. And here in verse 2 of chapter 15, we find yet another title for Jesus, the first time in the Gospel of Mark that the title King is used for Jesus. We've seen that in certain images implied, like at Jesus' baptism, for instance, when the voice from heaven speaks, "Thou art my beloved Son," echoing the royal psalm, Psalm 2. Jesus there is being identified as the Messiah King, but it's being implied. No one uses the title King for Jesus until it comes from Pilate, the Roman enemy, the Roman king of the land. And Pilate says to him, asked him in verse 2 of chapter 15, "Are you the King of the Jews?" And King becomes a title then that echoes over and over again in this first part of chapter 15. We find it again down in verse 9 when Pilate speaks, and he said, "Do you want me to release for you the King of the Jews?" Again, this title for Jesus. Then in verse 12, Pilate says to them, "Then what shall I do with the man whom you call the King of the Jews?" Which is ironic, because he's the one who's given the title of King of the Jews to Jesus, and here he's saying to the Jews that they are the ones who are calling Jesus the King of the Jews. Then in verse 18, when the Roman soldiers are torturing Jesus, they begin to salute him, "Hail, King of the Jews." That title is used again. Then in verse 26, the inscription that's put over Jesus, "The King of the Jews," that title appears again. And then in verse 32, in verse 31, the chief priests mocked him to one another with the scribes, saying, "He saved others, he cannot save himself. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross." So this title that has never appeared before in the Gospel of Mark for Jesus, now I'm in his fury saying, "I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. I will tell of the decree of the Lord. He said to me, 'You are my son, today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage, and the ends of the earth your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron, and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel.'" And then two in Isaiah 9. Isaiah 9, verses 2 to 7. "The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them has light shined. Thou hast multiplied the nation, thou hast increased its joy. They rejoice before thee as with joy at the harvest, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. For the yoke of his burden and the staff for his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor, thou hast broken as on the day of Midian. For every boot of the tramping warrior in battle tumult and every garment rolled in blood will be burned as fuel for the fire. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace there will be no end upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore." Again, a comparison to David and the kingdom that this king who will come, the kingdom that one will establish. The last one is Isaiah 11, verses 1 to 4. Talking about out of the stump of Jesse, a branch shall grow from his root. The Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. And his delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. He shall not judge by what his eyes see or decide by what his ears hear, but with righteousness he shall judge the poor and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. And he shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he shall slay the wicked. These prophecies of the king who is to come, it will be a king who practices justice and righteousness, who will establish Israel as the people ruling over the ends of the earth. But he shall also, each time is talked about political power, kingly kind of power with a rod and a staff. This is the kind of a king that when the Jews hear Pilate speak of Jesus as King of the Jews, this is the king that that they would be thinking of. So it, I think that's important to notice, of course, because it helps us understand why people had so much trouble seeing Jesus as for who he was. He came as a different kind of king. They were expecting a certain kind of king. And so that discrepancy was something that made them seek the destruction of Jesus. But I think that if we push this a little further, it's telling us something, too, about the audience to whom Mark is writing this book. Maybe they were an audience, too, who had, again, come to want Jesus to be this Old Testament kind of king, the kind of king Pilate is thinking of when he addresses Jesus as that title, a powerful king. A triumphant king in heaven. And Mark is writing to this audience to remind them again that Jesus came as a different kind of a king, not one with a scepter and a staff and power and might, but one who went to the cross. We've been tracing confessions. Who confesses Jesus? And here, the story that Mark tells becomes thick with confessions made by people who we would least expect to be confessing. And let's look at a couple of those. The high priest is the one we saw in chapter 14, verse 61. It's the high priest who calls Jesus Christ, the Son of the Blessed. The high priest is not meaning that as a confession when he says it, but we, reading the story, hear it as a confession. Then in chapter 15, we looked at the many times that people confess Jesus as king. It's Pilate who calls him king. It's the soldiers mocking and torturing Jesus who salute him as king of the Jews. It's the inscription over his head that that a non-believer wrote, the king of the Jews. And then it's the chief priests mocking Jesus, "Hail, king of the Jews, king of Israel, come down from the cross." Again, in the Gospel of Mark, we don't find confessions of who Jesus is coming from people who are the believers, the followers of Jesus. They've fled into the night and are not in the picture at all. But instead, the confessions of who Jesus is are coming from the lips of his enemies, from people who really are not meaning it to be a confession. But we who read the story now see them and hear their words as confession. Indeed, this is the King of the Jews. This points us also to one of the confessions that happens just after Jesus dies. We find, again, an unlikely source, a centurion this time, a Roman, someone who has not been a follower of Jesus. After Jesus dies, it's a centurion in verse 39 who stood facing him, saw that he thus breathed his last, and he said, "Truly this man was the Son of God." There's debate about whether that means the Son of God or a Son of God. Is he, with his words, acknowledging Jesus as a Son of God, a great man, or is this a confession? This is the Son of God. The Greek is ambiguous. I think, finally, it doesn't make that much difference what the centurion meant by the words. What's important is how we hear them, and we hear them as a confession of Jesus as the Son of God. Again, from the lips of not a follower of Jesus, but from a Roman, an unlikely source. Mark is a gospel, then, in which the cross, Jesus as a crucified Messiah, is what dominates. This is where the story that Mark is telling is moving toward this crucifixion of Jesus, not so much the resurrection, and we'll look at that more tomorrow, comparing the treatment that Mark gives to Jesus' resurrection, post-resurrection appearances, compared to Matthew, Luke, and John. It's very slim. The cross is really the culminating moment of the Gospel of Mark. And I think it's interesting to look at early Christian confessions to see what they did with the crucifixion, the resurrection, what was important to them. We find one such confession in 1 Corinthians 15, for instance, where Paul is talking about what is important to Paul about what Jesus did. In 1 Corinthians 15, starting with verse 3. And we think that this is an early Christian confession. "For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. It's intriguing to notice no words in this early Christian confession about what Jesus did in his life, what he taught, nothing. It focuses entirely on his death and that he was raised on the third day and on the resurrection. That is the significant work of Jesus the Christ to the early church and to the writer of the Gospel of Mark. Jesus is a Messiah who went to the cross, and that's what makes him the Messiah, not the healing and the prophecy and the works that he did with his life before that. Another thing to note in this story of Jesus' crucifixion, I think, is the presence of the women. Starting in verse 40, the disciples have all fled into the night. They drop out of Mark's story, and it seems as if there's no one who knows who Jesus is, who has been following him, who's present there. But then reading in verse 40, we find that looking on from afar, there were some women, Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James the younger and of Joseph and Salome, who when he was in Galilee followed him and ministered to him, and also many other women who came up with him to Jerusalem. This is another passage that Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza points to support her theory that women were disciples, followers of Jesus too. And it seems that they have not fled into the night or forsaken Jesus or abandoned him, but they have stayed there. I think in part they are able to do that because of the status of women in Jesus' time. They were not into crucifying women or arresting women, although they would do that to men. And so as women, given a lower status, they have more freedom at this point to be near Jesus. They don't have to fear arrest and death themselves as much as male followers of Jesus. I don't want to stress that too hard, though, because I think that that can diminish the courage of and the witness of the women's presence at the crucifixion. They were under some danger, I suppose, of being aligned with Jesus. And if we push too much their lowly status, it diminishes the courage of the witness of their presence at Jesus' death there. And it's fascinating to me how little we read about this group of many women who followed Jesus up to Jerusalem. That is not mentioned in the story much in Mark's story at all, but here it crops up, and it just opens up a whole world that is fun to toy with, to think where they were in the story and what significant role they played as disciples. We don't know, but this is another little snippet that that gives a hint of that, a window opening into a much bigger story.
I guess I really wonder how much legitimately can make out of that. I guess, how much does Mark kind of over-exaggerate? I don't know. Does Mark tend to do that?
You mean that in the very many other women?
In many other women, yeah.
What would be the purpose of that?
It's like the whole countryside comes out after, you know. Is that...
I guess you'd have to think what would be a purpose of an exaggeration here. The exaggeration, all the country of Judea, all Jerusalem, Mark is trying to make a point there that lots of people were interested in John the Baptist, and they were all, many people were receiving his baptism. I can understand the purpose from a literary point of view of an exaggeration at that point. I don't know what purpose would be served here in the story by an exaggeration of numbers.
If anything, it would exaggerate or highlight even more so the role of the women. Because if it's exaggerating, then he's really wanting to make a point, and the fact is that the women are there and the men are not. You could take it that way, I suppose.
You don't interpret the all the disciples forsook him and fled as an exaggeration at that point. There's sometimes you say all when you recognize it has a kind of purpose of making a point, and other times it's more accurate.
Well, although in fact they all hadn't, you know, Peter comes along.
John.
I think at that point, for the purpose of the story, Mark wants us to feel the utter desolation of Jesus. They all fled. When in fact Peter has sort of, well, he comes back, I guess, is what happens.
Isn't it though, isn't the statement there that they all fled, isn't that indicative that none of them understood? That they all misunderstood what his ministry was all about. Mm-hmm. So technically you could say they all forsook him.
Right.
To varying degrees maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact was that even the women who went the next morning to embalm his body, or not embalm, but anoint him, took him in the sense that they didn't understand either
mm-hmm.
what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if we have to defend Mark's exaggerations.
Yeah.
I hope I don't come across as anti-female. I really do like women. Is this part of Mark's irony?
How would you understand it then?
Well, if Mark is again capable of writing to a group of people where the women really were looked upon as inferior,
mm-hmm.
here always the witness to Jesus, or the support of Jesus, or the acknowledgement of who he is, or that he has some value, comes from these, you know, insignificant sources,
mm-hmm.
you know, or
mm-hmm.
less likely sources. Here it is, the women who are.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
No, I think that you can definitely understand it that way. That what kind of king is this? That his faithful followers at the end are the women, you know. That just, that I think that there's great irony in that. And again, you put that into a historical context, what must people have been thinking of Jesus, that these insignificant people like women were the followers who hung in there with him? He was worth crucifying. You know, what kind of a guy was this? I think that it very much works that way.
Mm-hmm. Do we really know where the disciples fled to? I mean, the fleeing was at the trial, right?
When Jesus was arrested.
Yes.
That's when they forsook him.
But where they fled to, whether they observed the crucifixion from some other far off place, so that maybe Mark ignores making any reference. Do we really know where, you know?
But isn't it significant that they're not mentioned again?
No, they're not, are they?
Mm-mm, they drop out of the story, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The tradition of the women at the cross seems to have some pretty strong impact
mm-hmm.
on the Christian community, because you look at the four diverse Christian communities that the gospel came out of, including John,
right.
which doesn't follow the synoptic tradition at all,
mm-hmm.
yet that tradition is still very significant for
mm-hmm.
the gospel. So I think there's, you know, important role there that maybe we've lost or missed, and even in Paul's writings, you know, he goes to the important people of the early community, who are people like, you know, Cleo and,
mm-hmm.
and Lydia, and the women's role of being central to the early part of the church was both startling, revolutionary, offensive to the surrounding community, and too hard for the later church to handle.
Right.
And I think that's an important part that is there that we need to take a look at.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How were the women seen in the Rome, in the community in Rome at that time? Do you know, were they somewhat more treated more civilly than women? Because he was writing to, you know, particularly, would he be trying to make an impact on the fact that women should be
recognized and respected more if he was writing to a community where he had Romans and Jews and, you know, all mixed. Mm-hmm. Would he be trying to say something to that community? And I don't know how the women were treated in Rome or in that society.
Yeah.
He might be trying to make a statement.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
To
them. Yeah. Well, let's think about that. The upper class women in Rome were educated, had more rights than Jewish women, but the middle and lower classes were quite subservient. From my readings, it was a class thing again in the Roman Empire, and in the Jewish culture, women's status was pretty much as property. Although there must have been a counterculture to that. You think of Martha and Mary living with their brother Lazarus, and these women following Jesus and giving to him out of their richness, which other Gospels write about too, as you've pointed out. There must have been a counterculture to this status of women also, and Jesus was in that.
Was there somewhere in Mark where it said that Joanna, the householder of Herod or whatever, was given money or was a follower of Jesus?
That's not in Mark. She's not mentioned in Mark. I think she's in Luke or Matthew. But they are talked about in each of the Gospels, these women who follow Jesus. And it's just a snippet. But if Mark was first, Matthew and Luke preserved that in their Gospels. It seems significant. And John, as you said, coming along in a different tradition, has that also. And so that's strong evidence, I think.
That was in Luke in chapter 8. Joanna, mm-hmm. the wife of Luke's parents, Stuart, mm-hmm. and many others contributing support to other private means.
Right.
In uh-huh. case they had some type of independence or mm-hmm. had their own means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, from the grocery money. Yeah. Okay, and just to finish up chapter 15, then, to note that they brought a linen shroud, which was the same thing that we saw that young man in verses 51 and 52 wrapped in, same word, and they wrapped Jesus' body in this linen shroud and laid him in a tomb. And we read in verse 47, the women, Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of Joseph, saw where he was laid, which sets the scene then for the Easter story in chapter 16. The central conflict that Mark uses to get Jesus crucified, every story needs a plot sort of to keep it moving along, and the plot that Mark develops is this tension between Jesus and the temple, and it's finally Jesus' criticisms about the temple that are what drive them to seek his destruction. That started back, we look at these in detail yesterday, but in Mark 11, verses 15 to 18, the story where Jesus drives out the money changers in the temple that's surrounded by the story of the fig tree. The temple in Jerusalem was like this fig tree that is not bearing, is what Jesus is saying. It's a temple of death, not a temple of life, not bearing fruit like it should be. That's one of the first incidents in Jerusalem between Jesus and the temple. Then in chapter 12, Jesus tells a parable about again, the temple in Jerusalem. A man planted a vineyard and set a hedge around it and dug a pit for the wine press and built a tower and let it out to tenants and went away into another country. Then he sends a servant, then he sends another servant, they kill that one. Finally he sends his son, and they kill the son. And then Jesus says, have you not read this scripture? The very stone which the builders rejected has become the head of the corner. this was the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes. And then in verse 12 of chapter 12, and they tried to arrest him, but feared the multitude, for they perceived that he told the parable against them. They understood what Jesus was saying, these temple rulers, but they left Jesus and went away. But again, the escalating tension between Jesus and the temple. Then that escalates more in chapter at the end of chapter 12 and going into chapter 13, where Jesus, starting in verse 38, is in the temple speaking, and he delivers a very cutting criticism of the scribes. Beware of the scribes who like to go about in long robes and to have salutations in the marketplaces and the best seats in the synagogues and the places of honor at feasts, who devour widows' houses and for a pretense make long prayers. They will receive the greater condemnation. Again, this escalating tension between Jesus and the temple. And then it's interesting to look at the story of the widow's mite in light of Jesus' criticism of the temple. Just following Jesus' criticism of the scribes is the story of the young widow, the poor widow who comes and puts in 2 copper coins, which make a penny. And Jesus called his disciples to him and said to them, "Truly I say to you, this poor widow has put in more than all those who are contributing to the treasury, for they all contributed out of their abundance, but she out of her poverty has put in everything she had, her whole living." I think that story works in at least 2 ways here in the Gospel of Mark. She's a Christly model. Again, she, like Christ, gives up his whole self. She gives up her whole self. She's a model of that, but she's also an example of what the actions of the scribes lead to. They devour widows' houses, Jesus says in his criticism, and then here is a widow whose house has been devoured. She has 2 copper pennies left, and she is putting those into the treasury. She's a model of Christly giving her all, but she's also an example of what the scribes' bad actions lead to. She's an example of a victim of the scribes as well. And that story works in an interesting way in this 12th chapter.
A victim because she feels she ought to give mm-hmm. her last 2 coins to the temple.
Mm-hmm. And they take it, these scribes, and use it to build grand buildings and wear nice robes. And so she's an example of a widow who's being devoured by the temple, too. As much as she's an example for all of us of the kind of giving we should give. Story works both ways there, I think.
Really reminiscent of Hosea.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, very much that way too, yeah. And then in chapter 13, Jesus predicts the destruction of the temple. The disciples say to him, "Oh, teacher, look what wonderful buildings." And Jesus says, "There will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." It's these charges then of the temple that get brought out at Jesus' trial in chapter 14, verse 57. The false witness says, "We heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another not made with hands.'" Jesus actually didn't say that, as we find in Mark, but that is one of the pieces of evidence brought up at his trial. And then in chapter 15, those words are echoed again and in verse 29. "And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, 'Aha, you who would destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross.'" The temple is working hard to preserve itself by crucifying this one who was a threat to it. And of course, the irony then, when it's the curtain of the temple that tears in two from top to bottom, a symbol of the destruction of the temple. They destroyed Jesus in order to save themselves, and they actually end up being the ones who are destroyed. Christ is now the head of the cornerstone of the temple, and the power of the temple has been destroyed by this Messiah on a cross. So the irony is just so thick here in the Gospel of Mark. I think for preaching, there are a couple other things that can be emphasized. Mark in this chapter alludes often to the Old Testament, to prophecies. And one of the things that can be stressed, I think, is that it might not look like it, but these dark events are proceeding according to God's plan. There's some plan at work in the evil events here. I think that Mark underscores that by alluding often to Old Testament passages in this 14th and 15th chapter. We can look at a couple of those. Mark 14:62, for instance, and Jesus said, "I am, and you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven," echoes Psalm 110, verse 1. "The Lord says to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool." And it also echoes Daniel chapter 7. Verse 13, one of the visions of the coming of the Son of Man. "I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a Son of Man, and he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him." That's one example. Do you want to look at others? I don't know. Mark 15, verse 24, echoes Psalm 22, verse 18. We can look at that one. "And they crucified him and divided his garments among them, casting lots for them to decide what each should take." Echoes Psalm 22, the psalm that we read at the beginning. "And they divide my garments among them, and for my raiment they cast lots." Mark echoing an Old Testament prophecy there in chapter 15, verse 29. "And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, aha, you who would destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross." Again, echoes Psalm 22 that we read at the beginning, verse 7. "All who see me mock at me, they make mouths at me, they wag their heads." Some of the language even, wagging their heads. Mark echoes that literally. Mark 15, verse 31, "So also the chief priests mocked him," is echoed again, Psalm 22, verses 7 and 8. And then chapter 15, verse 34, when Jesus cries, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" echoing Psalm 22, 1. Jesus says when he's arrested, "Let the scriptures be fulfilled." And it's as if Mark is showing the fulfillment then of this story. The scriptures are being fulfilled, even though it doesn't look like it in this story of Jesus. That's one thing that I think can be stressed for preaching. Another thing that can be stressed is that it might not look like it, but God is working in this evil event for good. Evil seems to be winning out, but it won't. And I think this is, I'd love to preach a sermon someday on irony, because the way irony works, of course, is that what you see on the surface is not all there is. There's more to the story. You have to move through the irony. And that's so much the way Mark's irony works here in this story of Jesus' death, that what we see on the surface is not all there is to the story. And irony in that way is good news gospel for us. That would be another interesting way to go with preaching, I think. So those were some of the things I wanted to share about this chapter 14 and 15 about Jesus' trial and crucifixion and death. Are there other comments or throw it open questions that you'd like to make?
Interesting observation to do with it, but he's driven out into the wilderness and tempted by Satan. And Mark has no drawing to conclusion for that story. Others will say after the temptation was it over, he went, etc. Mark doesn't have that, and yet there's no mention at all now in these last chapters of Satan that I can remember. Mm-hmm. Is there anything to be said about that, or is basically Mark filled with Satan after the conquest of the demons?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the evil is much more in human beings and human institutions in this part of the story. Yeah.
In a way, that's much more comforting because it's more of the way I see my situation
right
today.
Yeah. Those are our demons that we struggle with. Yeah.
Probably do more with the text than we should, but talk about these kind of parentheses that we could see. You have the chief priest rents his garment, which is maybe in front of blasphemy or something like that. You know, you could almost do that with the Holy of Holies. It's almost God renting God's garment at this blasphemy. Certainly, Hebrews and all that picked up on the image of that. Opens up the access of God's all creation. Mm-hmm. But in Mark, you could almost make something of that.
Something would have to do with the rending.
Yeah. Well, particularly it was essential, the veil kind of covering the body, all that, just open at that spot.
Go back to what you were saying, though. Isn't it in Mark where the demons are cast into the pigs and they jump in the creek or So I guess I'm not too sure I agree with you. It seems to me Mark does have a sense of Satan, demons, evil, you know.
We're not denying that. It's just interesting that that drops out of the story at a certain point. And the demons seem to be more humans and institutions and evil working its way out in those rather than in a demon.
Of course, the bottom line is that's where it really makes difference in terms of, life and in terms of...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just interesting, I thought, that this crux of evil's supposed triumph on the surface, Satan is not mentioned.
Mark doesn't.
And the crowd is really being the contestant of Satan.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not in Mark. It's like, again, I think we can't put the blame on Satan or the demons. It's us. And that's where Mark is wanting us to focus. Yeah.